This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Thanks, Margot, very much. And it's a pleasure to be back in Canberra. I've spent 3 whole years in Canberra, so it's not really new to me, but it's always great to be back. And it's an honor to be here representing my father, Bob Miller, who is the ichthyologist on the group. And this compilation was put together with my brother-in-law, Bob Kashner, and my sister, Bob's wife, Fran, who's unfortunately no longer with us. So, Bob's father was a California lawyer, and he hated being a lawyer. He wanted to be a naturalist, and since he couldn't be one, he always took his son out into the wilderness whenever he could. He would buy a ranch and lose money and eventually have to go back to law, but his son got the bug to be a naturalist. And he always intended to be a geologist. When he started university, he was a geology major. And on a desert field trip to Death Valley once with the geology group, he found some isolated springs, and he saw these tiny fishes in it. And he wanted to know where the fishes came from, and nobody could tell him. And his interest then shifted from rocks to animals, and he became a fish man out of that. And so he would go out into the desert areas like this with these isolated springs, and initially he caught the fish with his hat, which is all he had, and would bring them back, and when nobody could tell him, he went back out with nets and caught more fish. And he was quite persistent in doing this, and his efforts at trying to understand where these fishes came from eventually caught the attention of Carl Hubbs, who was then at the professor at the University of Michigan and was the North American expert in desert fishes. And as all professors do, looking for active students, he thought Bob should be working with him. And so this is 1929, about 10 years later in 1938, he asked Bob to join him in the field out in the desert to do some collecting. And out of that, they came to 2 agreements. Bob agreed to go to Michigan to work under Carl to do his PhD. And about 2 weeks after they first met up together in the desert, Carl agreed to Bob's request for his daughter's hand in marriage. And 2 years later, Bob married Carl's daughter there back in Michigan. And so he studied for 4 years at Michigan, and he did his PhD indeed on the little desert fishes that are in these little tiny springs out in the desert. He worked on the pupfish. This is a fish that's only 2 or 3 centimeters long. And when he finished his degree, he joined the Smithsonian Institution in 1944. And back in those days, the motto was join the Smithsonian and see the world. And he spent much of 1946 in Guatemala. And in 1948, he said goodbye to his lovely wife, left her with her 2 small children in California, and joined the Arnhem Land expedition with Mountford. So this we've all heard before. There's something like 50,000 specimens at the Arnhem Land expedition put together, and more than 30,000 of those expeditions were Bob and his crew's collection. So he was a tenacious collector. He already had that reputation before he came over. And Eric Joliffe, who joined the expedition and was a caricaturist, did this wonderful caricature of Bob that sort of reflects his. He was, and I think when Martin gave his talk from Jerry Blitner, Bob was always wanting to get every last fish and every different kind of fish he possibly could. And you'll note there on the bottom lines there, it says that he got his biggest hauls by treating the water with Darris root, which is a poison that doesn't poison the fish. It just stops them from being able to breathe, and so they float to the surface, but they're not too disturbed. And I'll come back to that point a little bit later. So Bob was he used these poisons for collecting. So in just reading through his field notes from that time is sort of interesting. Collection made with 40 pounds of Darris root or Barbasco root, collected in the Billabong, 25 pounds of rotenone, pool a few inches deep, 1/4 pound of Darris root, water temperature 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And I put these up so if you have trouble with my strong American accent, you can follow along. But not all of the pools were suitable for poison, so he had other collecting methods that he used. He would shoot them if he needed to. collected them by hand, collected them with three-pronged spears. And then he used, of course, more conventional methods, collected by night light and dip net, by hook, line, and spear, and collected in the billabong with a 125-foot gill net. And if you saw the National Geographic movie, you saw how many fish came out of those gill nets sometimes. But, you know, nobody collects alone. That's not something you do. And he had help, of course, from the expedition members. But definitely want to acknowledge that a great deal of the assistance was really provided by the indigenous Aboriginal people from Arnhem Land. And they not only helped with the physical activity, but more importantly, they were able to tell him the best places to collect fish. And you know, we're not collecting fish here to eat. We're collecting fish to get a representative sampling of everything that's out there. And so he really needed to know where you might be able to find those oddball fish that nobody else maybe cared a lot about. And so there was a tremendous amount of interaction and tremendous amount of help that was provided by the indigenous knowledge of that area that allowed him to get those 30,000 different fish out in there. The other interesting thing that made him relatively popular was going back to what Eric Jolliffe had written there, that when you poison a pool, basically everything comes up, and you really don't need all those fish, and there's nothing wrong with those fish. And so anything that wasn't needed for a collection then was free fare for anybody to pick up and have for dinner, because the fish were quite fine to eat. So he became known as the Good Fish Man. And he has a number of photographs in his collection of kids, and especially the kids picking up the fish. He has some catfish. Here's another fairly extensive collection that people are taking home for good tucker for the dinner. And I especially want to note Jerry Blitner here, and you heard Martin Thomas's wonderful stories about Jerry yesterday. And Jerry is about the same age as my father was, and the two of them really hit it off pretty well. And from, I was only 2 years old at the time, and of course have no memories directly, but from later stories, Jerry's the one person from that area that I had at least heard about as a young kid listening to my father tell stories. And Jerry really he took good care of my father. They worked together an awful lot, and he shared his knowledge of those places to find the best fish, and that was really a tremendous experience. And I never knew it at the time, but I was interested to find out quite recently that Jerry was also a very highly respected artist in the community. And I was delighted to see that many of his artistic renditions were of fish also. And these are carved and painted barramundi that are currently on sale in Florida if you would like to buy them. So it's an international art, and there are his pieces do appear in American art galleries. And I put this one up. Martin showed this picture too of Jerry and his wife and Donald, their son. And Donald's almost the exact same age as me, and so it was a tremendous pleasure because I'd seen this picture as a kid for me on Sunday when we had the reunion of descendants and family members of that expedition here at the museum to actually meet Donald in person. And we connect back through Donald, Jerry, and back to my father, and that was really a special opportunity for me. And Donnie's not here right now, but he's around town, so it was really great to meet him, and as well as his sisters, who are wonderful. So what happened to all those fish that Bob collected? Well, during the expedition, Bob received a letter offering him a professorship at the University of Michigan, and he accepted that. And so he never had an opportunity then to actually study any of the Arnhem Land fishes. As soon as he returned to America, he went to the University of Michigan. And the Smithsonian then hired Bill Taylor specifically to do the cataloging of and the identification of that collection. And that finally came out in 1964 as the Fishes of Arnhem Land. So one might ask, what's the legacy of Bob Miller? Because once he left here, he really never worked with those collections. And I think the legacy really comes in two flavors. You know, one was that he was a desert man, and he worked in the arid zone in the Americas. And being exposed to the much wetter environment of the Arnhem Land region gave him a new appreciation of another environmental system. And at the same time, it was also the first time he'd worked with indigenous peoples. And I think the combination of those two things had some strong influences on him, and he expanded the geography of his own research. Although he stayed working in the American Southwest Desert, he moved also into Mexico. He learned Spanish. He worked alongside indigenous Indian populations in the headwaters of various river systems, and he became the world expert on the fishes of Mexico. And his book, The Freshwater Fishes of Mexico, 600 plus pages of taxonomy that identifies all the fishes there, appeared posthumously just a couple of years ago. So that's one, I think, fairly direct legacy. The other one is less direct, but it's Australian in character, and that is that his participation in the expedition left an indelible imprint on his two young children at the time, my sister Frances and myself. And Fran's 2 years older than me. She was four, I was two. And although I have no direct memories, I was only two, Fran probably did, but there was such a strong impact on our family that both of us in sort of mid-career managed to find a way to come back to Australia ourselves and actually engage ourselves in the science over here. And Fran and her husband Bob, who's down here in front of me, and their family came over spent most of 1991 up in Lismore. They both taught at Southern Cross University. Bob developed a research program on the fishes in the Clarence River Basin. Bob's another fishman, and involved students in that. That led to publications. And importantly, he established with people at Lismore an exchange program with his university in the U.S. in New Orleans, where we had Australian students going to America to study, American students coming over here to Australia. And I think that's a direct legacy of this exchange program that started with the Arnhem Land Expedition jointly between America and Australia. Not only that, but their daughter, Molly, who accompanied Bob to the 50th Arnhem Land reunion that was held in Sydney, she was so impressed by the whole array of people that she herself decided to become a fish man or a fish woman. And she's just now completing her PhD in ichthyology as the fourth generation ichthyologist in that line. So that's no small feat, I think. And this trip is Bob's 16th trip to Australia, and my sister made 11 trips here. So there's a strong connection there as well. On my side, as I mentioned earlier, I've been affiliated with the ANU and spent 3 one-year stints, partly in Canberra, partly in the field, but tied here. And I've had a field program for most of the last 20 years over here. And much of what I've done, although I'm a geologist, not a fishman, much of what I ended up doing is strongly influenced by not only by my father's story of it, but it actually, in the end, although I never started out to do this, much of what I've done has been in continuity with the core intellectual thread of the scientific questions that motivated that original expedition. In particular, how did Aboriginal groups extract a living from the Australian landscape? How did the Australian landscape respond to a human presence on the landscape? And in the intervening 50 or 60 years, we've had available to us new tools, new researchers, new ideas, and it's shed some new light on some of these old questions. And so I just want to sort of put that into the context of the expedition and some of the recent advances. And when those folks came over here first, the Arnhem Land expedition, I think the prevailing view was that human occupation of Australia was just a few thousand years, 3, 4, 5,000 years. And we now know, in part from new discoveries in Arnhem Land, new dating tools, that we have a human presence on the landscape for something like 50 or 55,000 years, and in human terms, that's really forever. We also know now that some of the giant animals, giant marsupials, as well as some reptiles and birds were in Australia at the same time, shared the landscape, and we've learned much about the climate of Australia's past. And so just to remind us, some of these animals that were around when the first humans were also on the landscape. The largest marsupial that's ever lived, scaled to a person down there, a metric ton, Diprotodon, nothing like it lives. Zygomaturus, sort of a giant anteater that lived in the landscape, meat-eating carnivorous kangaroo, long gone. A whole fleet of kangaroo-like animals. This is Procoptodon, which is, instead of grazing on the ground, eats leaves and off of branches above it, much taller and bigger than a kangaroo. And, of course, Thylacoleia, the marsupial lion, a top-level predator that's no longer on the landscape. And various other giant animals. That's Wanambi, the giant snake, something like that big around on the landscape. And my two favorites in the end here, Megalania, which was something like from here to that table over there, about 7 meters long, and this giant bird, Geniornis, that's been the object of some of my interest. And what we'd love to find on the landscape are remains of these, their bones. What we really find, for the most part, is what's underneath it there, the eggshells of these giant birds. And they look something like that when you find them in the landscape. And just as a reminder then, here's there's 60 of these species, and not all of them giant, but many of them all scaled there to a person. They've all become extinct in the last 100,000 years or so, and this has been known for almost 200 years now, and the question has been why, and it still has currency in the modern world. What really happened to these big animals? And in my own area here is what we've been able to do is make the eggshells speak, or turn it another way. We've learned how to listen to what they've got to tell us. And so just to give you a quick summary of what we've learned, here's where we find them in these big blowouts in the sandhills. And if you start crawling around, you find fairly quickly that the computer dies just when you think it shouldn't. There we go. So here they are coming out of the landscape, and these are the eggshells of that extinct giant bird. And what do they tell us? They tell us their age, not how old they were when they died, but they tell us when they lived. They tell us what the birds were eating at the time. They tell us the level of aridity that was going on. And most recently, they've told us whether they've been eaten by humans or not. And just to show you that, I mean, here's anybody who's seen an emu eggshell up close knows that they don't really look like that. This is the eggshell of the extinct bird. And that little burnt corner up there tells us that somebody cooked that egg. After they cooked it, they shucked the shells around, and some of those eggshells landed next to the fire and touched a bit of coal and burnt one end of it. And some of these have been drilled. There you can see right over here how this tapered thing, in cross-section, you have this tapered slope, so somebody drilled a little hole in that. And here's a collection of some of these ones over here have all been in the fire and totally burnt, and these are partially burnt. And just to be sure that this isn't just some kind of staining, we've done several of these, and here's we've examined them. So just to look at this one, I'll turn it around. And what we did was inside the eggshell are protein remains made up of amino acids, which, if they get really hot, decompose and disappear. So we did a little transect. We analyzed each one of those pieces to see if there were any amino acids left in it. And so here we're plotting the concentration of the amino acids across the top, and what you can see is in this most burnt-looking corner, nothing's there. It's been completely burnt away. As you move away from the burnt edge, there's a little bit, and once you get out farther and farther away, the amino acids are present in the levels we'd find in an unburnt shell. So this confirms that that color is not due to staining. It's actually done by burning. So they also tell us what the birds ate, and this becomes really interesting. So here's the emu, you know, and the question we asked was, did the appearance of humans on the landscape somewhere around 50,000 years ago have any impact on what's available for the animals to eat? And the nice thing about emu, which is not extinct, it's extant on the landscape, is that it goes right through the event where all the other animals go extinct. So we can actually track something past the extinction event. And so what we're plotting here, this measure tells us whether they're eating grass up here. Anything up in this range is eating 100% grass. Down here it's 100% trees and shrubs, and in between. And we have 150,000 years. So this is from 150,000 years to 45,000 years ago. They ate sometimes all grass, sometimes all trees and shrubs, and somewhere in between. Now, people appear on the landscape, and what happens? Emus are opportunistic eaters. They'll eat anything out there that's good to eat. This whole space here of whatever that diet was completely disappears afterwards. And it's more impressive if you take a statistical term, which is the variance, which describes how tightly clustered samples are about a mean. Tremendous variability. They just ate any old thing that was around here, and then very constrained variability afterwards. So something happens on the landscape where the food sources available to the birds has been completely altered, beginning the same time humans appear in the landscape and continuing on uninterrupted to the present day. And what about our extinct bird, we might ask? So here's that same plot on the exact same scale from the same localities as our extinct bird. Here's handsome Jenny Ornis. And what you can see is that the range of food sources for Jenny Ornis living in the same landscape is much more restricted. And the take home from this is picky eaters have trouble if landscapes change. And so we think that the main cause of the extinction here is that those animals that had a specialized diet were at risk from change, those that were generalist feeders. So what can cause it? And this is still a big debate in the community, but we think that the changed fire regime, as humans appear in the landscape and for a whole range of reasons, have a deliberate burning regime, and this may well have been the primary factor that changed the landscape and resulted in impact on the landscape in which some of the large animals, most of the large animals, disappear. So just to finish up, if I've got it right there, look at that. So to conclude then, the intellectual threads of that Arnhem Land expedition still motivates our questions today. It really, a core question, not just for Arnhem Land, not just for Australia, but really for the whole planet, is, you know, what's the footprint of humans on a landscape? Where's our place there? And these questions then remain alive in the contemporary world, where we ponder really how humans everywhere fit into their landscape and how we can manage a sustainable future. Thank you very much.
Questions, comments, and identify yourself, if you wouldn't mind, when you get the mic. Tomo.
You mentioned that your father used Darris root to poison the water holes, and I guess that's familiar to many of us. You also mentioned he used two other substances which are not familiar to me. Can you elucidate a bit?
If I'm correct, and Bob might help me there, I think Darris root and rotenone are the same exact. It's just two names for the same thing. The barbasco root, I don't know if that's different, Bob. Do you know? So that's not familiar. I'm familiar with Darris root and rotenone because I used it with him myself. Barbasco root must be something that does basically the same thing. I mean, so what these poisons do is basically prohibit the gills of the fish from absorbing oxygen from the water. And so the fish essentially suffocate. They no longer can control their bladder, and so they tend to float to the surface. Sometimes they'll eventually recover and swim away, but if you're quick, you can nab them. Sometimes they're just dead as a doornail. But they're quite okay to eat, and so this was one of the things that made him quite popular with the local folks up there.
Hands over there.
Diana Laidlaw, I am not familiar with Darris root. Is it a local indigenous substance that the people used for ever, or something that your father introduced to the area?
Yes, so this was something that they would have brought in that 47 tons of gear with them, knowing that it would be typically people collectors use seines because they do less damage to the fish, but there's certain settings where using nets is very difficult, and in those settings, using a poison is a common tool. So they came equipped with the poisons, and I don't know that any of the indigenous people had a particular poison that they used.
I was just going to comment that usually it's in a powdered form, and they probably brought in, you know, many, many hundreds of pounds of the rotenone or Darris from Darris.
Well, just while we're getting the mic, did he if you, you may not know this answer, but did he actually, your father, explore any natural poisons? Did he, do you know whether he...
Is this working? Okay. It's such a... At the time, it was probably a fairly recent discovery of how effective it could be. And another interesting thing that Gift didn't add is that for some reason, pigs are also susceptible to rotenone. So if you're in a farmer's creek and you're putting down rotenone, the pigs come in, you've got to get out of there quickly. So... But now other poisons are used too. They use
I meant indigenous, of the from that landscape.
I think they brought the thing that with them.
Yeah, I don't know, and if we had the Groot Eilanders here, we might know it. Perhaps Ray can help out.
Yeah, Bob brought in the Darris root or rotenone, but the Aborigines were using the leaves of Barringtonia. In the same way as the Darris root was used in Central America.
Yes, the expert. The botanist. Oh, my God. What a, yes, the botanist. He'd know.
Bob, I think the last camp before he was leaving for the United States, I went down with him to the East Alligator River at the landing point. And Bob poured, he gave me a fishing line. Mm-hmm. I've never really fished before, but I got 10 catfish in about 10 minutes. I was just so proud of myself. And then Bob put in the last of his rotenone into the East Alligator River as the tide was going out. And the slaughter was absolutely amazing. There were thousands of catfish, thousands of skipping trout, or what do they call them, and sharks and such. It was...
Were there plenty of blackfellas around to eat it?
I don't know what happened. I went back to my botanical collecting.
After the slaughter. Okay. Question... Identify yourself, yes.
Val Attenborough from Australian Museum. Mic on?
Yeah. Yes.
I was just going to say, in many parts of Australia, plants are used as fish poisons for fishing, so it'd be surprising if they didn't use similar things in Arnhem Land. And Annie Clark has just tapped me on the shoulder. And
I was going to say Barringtonia.
Mangrove.
Barringtonia in the Liberty, but Professor Specht already just mentioned that, so... But there's lots of fish poisons right across.
Thanks, Annie. Up the back, just behind you. Whoa, they were flying this morning.
Hello. Tess Fitzgerald. I'm a student of Yorongo Mata, and I translated stories, that is certainly a part of Indigenous knowledge, and the Yorongo still use it, to succumb the fish. Yeah. So there's a Yolngu word for the Darris root.
What was the Yolngu word? We missed it.
I can't remember.
Oh, okay,
I'll have to refer to my dictionary, but there is a word.
Thank you.
I mean, my own experience is that Indigenous peoples are good botanists, and they learn the wide range of uses that plants can provide them almost everywhere.
Now, I'm Bill Arney from Northern Territory. I really lived in the bush all my life. We never had fish line. I'll just tell you all about this, what you're talking about. For us, we use what a tree called catapercha. We take it just 3-4 barks, just enough to catch a few fish, throw them in the water because the bark is red, going down. They think the meat's coming down. What's that mean? The milk flies out, it hits their eye. Doesn't kill them, but they make them go mad. Send them out right up to the bank, but if you leave it too long, all of the fish get stung in the eye. Grey fish and everything all come out of the bank. But if you could get enough fish, you have to dive down and get the bark out and throw them out. Otherwise, you'll destroy all the water out with the fish gone. But the bird will just come from every side to take the fish straight away. That's in our side, there's a catapercha. Mm. Now, down the river, at Catherine River, or right across to Arnhem Land, all the way down to Port Keys, they use another type of tree. In Aboriginal name, we call it Mungyan, with the yellow flower weaving flowers they got in the water. And that's the bark off that they get and it's thrown in the water off. And then also with that sting in their eye, you know, and it makes them go mad. But when we throw that bark, I seen a big catfish with barramundi shoot himself out in the bank. He was that mad, bucket away and come back. You have to dive down the water and get the bark out quick, and that's what it is. And that's the bark now. Doesn't poison it, but if you leave it so long, they will get poisoned. But not really poisoned, but that'd be up in the bank with the mouth open, gone around. But they're feeding the bird at the same time. You know, that's what...
Oh, thanks very much for that. It's great. We've got Indigenous and non-Indigenous knowledges coming nicely together here. Another? Yes, Ray.
Hugh Cairns.
Hugh, sorry.
Bill told me last year or two that when they were building the road up to Kununurra from Catherine, the road builders needed fish for supper, so they put dynamite in the river and it destroyed the breeding grounds of barramundi in that whole area. So that's our modern way of doing the fire destruction.
One of the other time-honored ways of collecting fish is to shock them, and explosives and electric shockers are commonly used in as ways of getting fish out of the water.
Potassium cyanide is used sometimes when you're doing sampling of small species in coral reefs and things like that. Kind of dangerous, but you got to be careful.
Nothing will stop us from getting our vaccine.
Nothing will stand between a man and his fish. Any more? We can take one more. We're so nicely on time. Oh, three more. How quick can you be? Okay, Martin, and then... Left, right.
just a quick one. I like that photo. I think it's Professor Hubbs, who was the mentor for your father, and it had university expeditions on the truck. And I'm just wondering about this word expedition, because it seems that in the United States it's used more in terms of just a field trip can be an expedition, whereas I think in we tend to think of something a bit sort of grander than that.
Are you saying that wasn't a grand expedition? a little aside on that expedition, you saw his three children there and a graduate student in the car, and in order to keep his kids engaged in the collecting, because kids' minds tend to wander, he offered rewards, 5 cents for each new different kind of fish they hadn't gotten, $1 if they found a new species that had never been described before, and $5 when they found a new genus that had never been found before. Those were the days.
Thank you.
Oh, hi, my name's Deb Sims. I'm just amazed at the amount of shell material you had on that slide. I just kind of mind-blowing. So the numbers of these giant emus, their distribution across the desert areas. I'm just amazed at how big a food source that would have been for the indigenous people.
Yeah, it's undoubtedly a little bit aliased. There's a differential preservation. So eggshells are a different composition than bones, and they, as long as there's a little buffering, so limestone around, they'll preserve for tremendously long periods of time. You can find more dinosaur eggshells than you can find dinosaur bones, for example. So some of that is a reflection of just preservation potential of eggshell versus bones. But because they are really amazingly abundant, once you get an image in your mind of what you're really looking for and you don't take your eyes off the ground, both eggshells of both the extinct Jenny Ornis and of the emu are extremely widespread across the arid zone. And in many instances, we find, even with the emus, burnt emus. And so clearly people were utilizing the eggshells for omelets, the eggs for omelets, and discarding their eggshells widely throughout the landscape. And I'm sure they understood exactly how those birds, where they nested, and I wish I could talk to somebody from back then to learn a little bit more about this.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.